Good morning. Yet another group of American families are waking up this morning grieving after a school shooting. As parents across the country prepare to send their kids to school today, what should they tell them? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The Trump administration is shaking things up at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. CDC Director Susan Munares has been let go less than a month after taking over. What's going on? Also, Hurricane Katrina had a lasting legacy on the education system in New Orleans. What's left 20 years later? It's Thursday, August 28th. Happy birthday to Jennifer Coolidge of White Lotus and Legally Blonde fame. The actress is 64 years old today. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Thousands gathered at prayer vigils across Minneapolis last night, honoring the victims of a deadly shooting at a Catholic church and school. At Lyndhurst Park, Mayor Jacob Frey pleaded for stricter gun control laws.
Each and every one of us must commit to making this all mean something greater than just the words. We need to have true gun reform right now. Not tomorrow, not the next day.
A gunman opened fire through the windows of Annunciation Catholic Church and school during Mass on Wednesday morning, killing two children and injuring 17 other people. The 23-year-old shooter later died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. The director of the CDC is refusing to step down, even after federal health officials posted online that she was out of a job on Wednesday. Jess Mador of member station WABE reports that Susan Munares was sworn in less than a month ago.
The Washington Post first reported Munares is ousting, citing unnamed officials with the Trump administration who said she'd refused to commit to changing COVID vaccine policy without first consulting with her advisors. It comes just weeks after a shooting at the main CDC campus in Atlanta that damaged buildings and killed DeKalb County Police Officer David Rose. In a tweet, HHS thanked Munares for her service and said Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is confident CDC will continue to be vigilant in protecting Americans against infectious disease. For NPR News, I'm Jess Mador in Atlanta.
Exclusive reporting from NPR examines the role the U.S. played in Gaza's humanitarian crisis nearly 2 years into the war. NPR's Fatma Tanis reports former Biden administration officials say they struggled to get food and water into the region as Israel restricted the flow of aid.
NPR spoke to more than two dozen former U.S. officials in the Biden administration. With the situation in Gaza worsening in recent months, many of them said they were asking the question, did we do enough to prevent this? They said the administration constantly pressured Israel to allow more aid in, but ultimately, President Biden and his advisors were reluctant to criticize Israel publicly or to withhold U.S. military aid to Israel. Humanitarian groups told NPR that the Trump administration has not pushed Israel at all on the issue of aid, even during Israel's three-month blockade of Gaza. In the end, humanitarian experts say both the Trump and Biden administrations failed to get Israel to change its aid policies. Fatma Tanis, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Pope Leo is making a strong appeal to the world to help end the deadly conflict between Israel and Hamas. During his weekly audience at the Vatican, the pontiff called on Israel to stop the collective punishment and forced displacement of Palestinians in Gaza. He also called for the release of the remaining hostages taken by Hamas in southern Israel. North Korea says its leader, Kim Jong-un, will join other heads of state for a military parade in China next week. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports that Japan formally surrendered 80 years ago on September 3rd, marking the end of World War II.
North Korean state media announced that Kim will visit Beijing at the invitation of China's leader, Xi Jinping. China's foreign ministry released a list of 26 heads of state and government who will attend. Slovakia's prime minister is the only Western one. Kim has not visited China since 2019. China has historically been North Korea's main ally, but Kim has recently drawn closer to Russian President Vladimir Putin, who will also attend the parade. China is celebrating its victory in what it calls the War of Resistance against Japanese aggression, which lasted from 1931 to 1945. Over 35 million Chinese soldiers and civilians were killed or wounded in the conflict. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
Stocks across Asia closed mixed today. Shares traded higher in China and Japan, while markets in Hong Kong posted losses. On Wall Street, Dow futures are trading mixed at this hour. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Sattva, committed to making handcrafted mattresses that help lull people to sleep and keep them sleeping soundly. More information is at SAATVA.com/NPR.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
Nearly every Minnesotan has heard of hometown sports superstars Alan Page, Kirby Puckett, and Joe Mauer. But how about Dan Patch? One of Minnesota's most famous, greatest athletes is little known these days. He lived at the turn of the 20th century, and he was not a man. Dan Patch was a pacing horse that broke speed records and rose to fame by never losing a single race. But longtime Minnesota sports writer Jay Wiener says this horse became a sports legend because he was the first heavily commercialized athlete in Minnesota and probably the country.
Dan Patch, he turned into a commercial object, a marketing tool.
Wiener says Dan Patch became a household name from pitching products.
There were Dan Patch watches, Dan Patch thermometers, Dan Patch automobiles, and Dan Patch washing machines, and they took 2 minutes, which was his record of running a mile.
Dan Patch's owner, Marion Willis Savage, became very rich, but he also became very close to his horse, to the point where he literally could not live without him. Dan Patch died on July 11, 1916. Marion Savage died just 32 hours later.
MN90 is a co-production of the Minnesota Historical Society and AMPRS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, online at mn90.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in New Orleans.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Good morning. It was only their third day of the new school year. The first all-school gathering at the Annunciation Catholic School in Minneapolis, a celebratory mass at the Catholic Church connected to the school. But the prayer service was violently interrupted on Wednesday with gunfire and with death. And after the shooting, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey said he was tired of the same ineffective response after these all-too-common acts of violence.
Don't just say this is about thoughts and prayers right now. These kids were literally praying.
The shooter fired through the stained glass windows of the church where nearly 200 children were gathered. Two children were killed. More than a dozen others were wounded, along with three adults in their 80s. Mayor Frey voiced what many in Minneapolis and around the country are feeling.
These are kids that should be learning with their friends. They should be playing on the playground. They should be able to go to school or church in peace without the fear or risk of violence, and their parents should have the same kind of assurance. These are the sort of basic assurances that every family should have every step of the day, regardless of where they are in our country.
Minnesota Governor Tim Walz also mourned with the city, addressing the public in an afternoon press conference on Wednesday.
A community behind us, Annunciation Church and School, committed to academics, service, and Catholic values, filled with the first days of school, of beautiful children, going to learn those values, share with their teachers and their classmates. And instead of that joy and that curiosity and that learning, they were met with evil and horror and death.
Later, Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar joined NPR's All Things Considered.
There is going to be stories told of the church personnel that were in there, of the teachers, of other kids, older kids, protecting younger kids when this whole story is told.
For the children who survived, Annunciation School Principal Matthew DeBoer had this message he shared at a news conference.
I love you. You're so brave. And I'm so sorry this happened to us today. We lost two angels today.
Law enforcement, meanwhile, are searching for a motive. Minneapolis Police Chief Brian O'Hara.
We are all working tirelessly to uncover the full scope of what happened, to try and identify a motive why it happened, and whether there are any other further details.
FBI Director Kash Patel said in a social media post that his agency is investigating the shooting as an act of domestic terrorism and a hate crime. For updates on the investigation, the people affected by yesterday's shooting, keep listening to your NPR station or go to npr.org. Now, of course, every shooting is traumatic for the people who live through it or see it happen, but school shootings bring a whole other level of fear because most kids have to go to school and their caregivers have to send them. So we've called someone who's thought a lot about how families can navigate the understandable fear of school shootings as well as other school-based violence. She's Melissa Breimer. She's a clinical psychologist with the UCLA Duke National Center for Child Traumatic Stress, where she is the director of terrorism and disaster programs. Ms. Breimer, thank you so much for speaking with us. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So, of course, millions of families and children may be preparing this morning to start another school day. How can parents prepare their children for a return to school where they may hear about the bad things that happened to children in Minnesota?
First of all, parents are going to be scared right now. Check in with yourselves first before you have a conversation with your child. Take that breath. Acknowledge that what feelings are coming up. And then have that conversation with your child about first, what have they heard about the event and what do they need before they go to school? Many kids learn different coping strategies. Let's use them this morning. Let's take a few breaths. Let's maybe put a note in their book bag of how much you love them and who the helpers are at school that can just give that little comfort this morning, whether their teacher, their counselor, their nurse, their administrator, even their bus drivers are all there today to help them to have a successful day at school today.
And when you say check in with yourself, I mean, I'm sure, you know, that resonates because I'm sure that, you know, people, caregivers listening, even teachers listening to this conversation may be thinking, I still feel upset. I'm anxious. What can you do to get yourself together as an adult?
Yeah, just as we're telling the kids to use their coping strategies, us adults have to use our coping strategies. Are we actually talking with our friends, our loved ones? Are we using some of our breathing techniques? Are we labeling the feelings that are coming up? And some of us may want to step into action and get involved in our schools, be part of the school safety committees, be part of the school climate activities so that we can make sure that we're making a difference in our own kids' schools' lives.
You know, to that end, I'm imagining that some parents or caregivers might be skeptical or even distrustful of the emergency protocols and security measures schools are putting into place. You know, a lot of school systems are instituting these no phone policies where a lot of parents might be saying, well, wait a minute, I hear about something like this happening. I want my kid to have their phone. What do you say to families who might be questioning whether the efforts are effective, whether the protocols are effective?
Well, I think first and foremost, check in with your schools. What are those protocols? How much they review them? And, you know, after these types of events, sometimes we look at, do those protocols need to be adapted? But we do know that these protocols do make a difference and they do avert many events. And so we don't want to throw out everything, but sometimes we might have to look at, is there things that we're learning from this event that we need to be adapting our protocols?
And I think I hear you saying is that parents should acknowledge the obvious, that they should not try to pretend that this didn't happen. But how do you have suggestions about how to kind of have this conversation without overwhelming kids with too much information that they may not be ready for?
Yes. So my conversations with younger kids is very different from teenagers. Younger kids, bring it closer to home. They may wonder, did this happen? Could this happen at my school? And this is where we want to let them know that they're currently safe and help them to point out some of those safety measures that there are already in place at school. You know why mom and dad have to check in at the front office? That's one way that your school is trying to keep you safe. Your teacher's there, or the counselor's there. Point out some of those features that all the helpers that are there.
And before
adolescents
go,
are going to want to talk about, sorry, adolescents okay. are going to want to talk about maybe why this stuff is happening and what they what we need to be doing as a society to change this. And they're going to need a lot more details.
Just 30 seconds left, though, and this is obviously a broader conversation. What about kids who may be showing signs of trouble where they may be aggressive or vulnerable to outside influences as briefly as you can? And, of course, we need to talk more about this.
We know that there's a lot of help in schools and in our communities for kids that are struggling right now. If you're worried about your child, talk to your physician, talk to a mental health provider, find ways that you can get your child help. The help is there.
That's Melissa Brimer. She's with the UCLA Duke National Center for Child Traumatic Stress. Ms. Brimer, thank you so much for these insights. Very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
When New Orleans flooded in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, one of the hardest hit areas was the Ninth Ward. Over the last 20 years, much sweat and tears have gone into this community's rebuilding, and much of that is due to the people who never left, including the young people. People like Brittany Penn. She was just 16 years old when Katrina hit. She remembers returning to her house with her parents.
So you had no power, but was the house standing or what?
The house was still standing. Mm-hmm. We had plaster walls. Mm-hmm. So basically we were all in there, me, my mom, and my dad, and we were just with the bleach and just bleaching walls and throwing out, you know, all of our furniture, all of our belongings.
Today, she still owns that house, along with a hair salon and barber shop located in one duplex and multiple housing units that she's turned into rentals, whose renovations she directed or did herself. Enter her shop on Desire Street, and you can see that it's thoroughly infused with her energy and optimism. The barbershop side features sleek black and white decor. On the salon side, the walls are bright pink and sparkly chandeliers hang from the ceiling.
So this is Lace Exclusive Salon Barber and Spa.
Penn remembers the hard work of reclaiming her family home from the flood damage, but somehow, instead of turning her off to renovating and rebuilding, it lit a fire in her to do more.
So this is the barbershop area. That's Calvin, our barber.
Hello.
In the barbershop, Joshua Holmes is waiting his turn. He's a loyal client.
I had hair and I don't have hair, so yeah.
But he still comes in for a clean shave and to support a local business.
I mean, it's a beautiful thing to come back and give back to the community. That's what everybody wants to do, especially after Katrina. But when you got people like her that comes around, you don't have to go outside the night walk. When you're from it and you got things you want, and you don't have to leave, it's a beautiful thing.
Penn still lives on Desire Street, a few doors down from her shop, but on a street still pockmarked with empty lots. She's watched homes and local businesses disappear after Katrina, and she wants to change that.
So what I've been doing is just reinvesting into my community. So even though, like, you know, I'm able to move anywhere, I choose to stay here in my community, like I still live on Desire Street.
She's on her way. In addition to the rental home she's renovated, she's looking at commercial properties now to give other entrepreneurs like her a place to build their dreams and give back too.
This is NPR News.
Coming up September 6th, we are so excited for Grand Rapids River Fest. Opening up will be Alan Sparhawk, who recently talked with Kari Hedlund about his new album with Trampled by Turtles.
I remember at the time going like, man, I can't tell if this is any good. I'm questioning myself a lot here, but I don't know. There was a little bit of obligation, I think, because those guys had made room for me, put their trust in me, so to speak. I kind of had to tell myself, you know, I just need to push through and just sing, do the best I can and trust that I'm in the hands of good people. I feel like I did. I found my voice. Thank you for thinking of me, and I'm glad to be there. Mim and I grew up out past Bemidji, so I'm looking forward to it.
Grand Rapids River Fest with Alan Sparhawk opening up, then Jeremy Albino, Margot Price, and Courtney Barnett. Get your tickets at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com.
Turn up the problem. PR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org. From AG1, maker of a drinkable multivitamin now available in three new flavors, tropical, berry, and citrus. Learn more at drinkag1.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. The Department of Health and Human Services says the new director of the Centers for Disease Control has been fired.
HHS announced Wednesday that Susan Menares was no longer CDC director less than a month after being sworn in. Hours later, though, attorneys representing Menares posted on X that she had not resigned or been notified by the White House that she had been fired.
NPR health policy correspondent Selena Simmons-Duffin is here to explain. Good morning, Selena.
Morning, Leila.
So first, just remind us who Suzanne Menares is and her path to CDC director.
Well, she's a microbiologist who's held several roles as a career scientist in the federal government. She was President Trump's second choice to lead the agency after former Congressman Dave Weldon, who couldn't get enough support in the Senate. So Menares did get through the Senate confirmation process. She was sworn in on July 31st. And she came in to lead a public health agency that suffered major staff and budget cuts, that's been disparaged by members of the Trump administration. Then in her first week on the job, a gunman fired hundreds of bullets into the agency and a police officer was killed.
So then what happened Wednesday?
Well, first, the Washington Post reported that Menares was out. The Department of Health and Human Services confirmed that reporting a few hours later. The Post on X said that, quote, Susan Menares is no longer director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We thank her for her dedicated service to the American people.
But that's not the end of it, right?
Yeah, right. So just after HHS posted that, at least five really extremely senior career scientists at CDC announced their resignations. They include the agency's chief medical officer, the director of the Center on Emerging Infectious Diseases. Several wrote scathing resignation letters, including Dimitri Daskalakis, who directed the Center on Immunizations and Respiratory Diseases. He shared his letter on X and said that no expert from his center had ever briefed Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. on measles or bird flu or anything else, and said, I'm not sure who the secretary is listening to, but it is not us. And he also wrote, quote, having to retrofit analyses and policy actions to match inadequately thought out announcements in poorly scripted videos or page long X posts should not be how organizations responsible for the health of people should function. And then a twist. Attorney Mark Zaid shared on social media he was representing Susan Menares and she had not resigned. And late last night, he wrote in a statement that, quote, as a presidential appointee, Senate-confirmed officer, only the president himself can fire her. For this reason, we reject notification that Dr. Menares has received as legally deficient, and she remains as CDC director. We have notified the White House counsel of our position.
And really quickly, what spurred all of this?
Well, I spoke to a senior CDC leader. It sounds like there was a meeting late last week with HHS leadership that went very badly. And what this does is it leaves CDC without a director and without really senior staff leaders at a time when the agency is really struggling.
That's NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin. Thank you, Selena.
Thank you.
Okay, we have other news in public health, a big change coming to COVID-19 vaccines. The Food and Drug Administration just approved the next round of shots, but the agency is imposing new limitations on who is eligible. And NPR health correspondent Rob Stein joins us now to talk about this. Good morning, Rob.
Good morning, Leila.
Okay, so what are the new restrictions?
Well, Leila, until now, the COVID shots were available to anyone ages 6 months and older, mm-hmm. but the new updated Moderna, Pfizer-BioNTech, and Novavax shots have only been approved for people who are at increased risk of getting really sick from COVID, and that's defined as people who are 65 or older. Anyone younger has to also have other health issues that make COVID especially risky, like a weak immune system, asthma, or maybe like heart disease.
Okay, so why? What's the reason behind limiting who qualifies?
So Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and other top Trump administration health officials argued that at this point in the pandemic, it's time to rethink how we use the vaccines. They say so many people have so much immunity now that most otherwise healthy people just don't need to keep getting jabbed every year. They also question the safety of the vaccines and how well they work, even though there's plenty of evidence that they're very safe and work very well.
So what are public health officials saying about this decision?
Well, they're up in arms. You know, people who are critical of the COVID vaccines may be welcoming the changes, but most public health experts I've talked to say, look, many healthy people may not necessarily need to keep getting vaccinated, but they say they should have the option if they want to, just to cut the chances of getting sick at all and missing work and school or ending up with long COVID or, you know, spreading the virus to someone else like grandpa or some other vulnerable loved one. I talked about this with Michael Osterholm. He's at the University of Minnesota.
These vaccines can save lives. We have demonstrated time and time again that they are very important in reducing serious illness, hospitalizations, and deaths. And that, in the end, is a very, very powerful tool to be used, not to be restricted. This is unfortunately another disaster waiting to happen.
And experts like Osterholm are especially worried about what this means for healthy pregnant women and very young children. The CDC recently dropped recommendations that they get protected, even though COVID can still be very dangerous for them.
Okay, so Rob, I'm not 65. I don't have an underlying condition. If I want the vaccine, can I get it?
Well, Leila, for many people like you, this probably means you just won't be able to walk into your local drugstore anymore to get a shot if you don't fall into one of the eligible categories.
Okay.
But you still may be able to get the shots by getting a doctor to prescribe them for you as what's called off-label. But, you know, that would require getting an appointment and taking the time to go see a doctor, which may be just too much of a hassle for a lot of people. And it's also unclear now if insurance will pay for the shots, which aren't cheap. So public health experts worry that all the uncertainty, conflicting messages, and hurdles could end up meaning far fewer people getting vaccinated at a time when the number of people still rolling up their sleeves is already pretty low. And remember, COVID is still making lots of people sick and killing between 100 and 200 Americans every week. In fact, we're in the middle of another summer surge right now, and yet another wave is expected this winter.
That's NPR health correspondent Rob Stein. Thank you, Rob.
You bet, Leila.
This is NPR News.
Amtrak is returning to the Mississippi coast for the first time since Hurricane Katrina made landfall 20 years ago. The cities along that route are still living with the hurricane's aftermath.
90% of Pascagoula was flooded and about 10% had flood insurance.
I'm Elsa Chang, a train ride along the Gulf Coast on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock today here on People Powered KAXC. Your local host will be Andrew DeZingle. Good morning. It is 5:29. Thanks for listening to the Thursday morning show. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up in a few moments, our daily dose of phenology with John Latimer. John will look back at his nature notes for this date, August 28th.
Patchy fog early today, then becoming mostly sunny, highs 67 to 75. Our overnight lows in the mid-40s to low 50s, and tomorrow mostly sunny, highs 71 to 76. You can pay nothing to get that old or damaged car towed away, even if it doesn't run. Your donation of a car, boat, or other vehicle is tax deductible. You save time and money while defending the KAXE programs that you love. Call 855-277-2346 for details, or you can visit kaxe.org. Click on Give to learn more. Local author Anne Marie Erickson celebrates the launch of her new book, In the Evening We'll Dance, a memoir in essays on love and dementia, Thursday, September 4th, 7 p.m. at the McCroskey Art Center in Grand Rapids. Erickson will read brief excerpts of the book and sign copies. And Native American Music and Arts Festival is Sunday, August 31st from 10 to 5 at the Mille Lacs Indian Museum and Trading Post near Onamia. There will be artists, demonstrations, live music, and food trucks. Let us know what's happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org. And we invite you to join us for Grand Rapids River Fest Saturday, September 6th, featuring Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Find tickets and more information at grandrapidsriverfest.com. There is more ahead from Morning Edition here on People Powered KAXE. Right now, it's time to hear from John Latimer.
On today's date, August 28th in the year 2012, the first high bush cranberry are ripe. But don't worry, you'll have plenty of time to observe them. These are not a very flavorful berry in the fall. And I have heard it said that they just need a couple of frosts in order to sweeten up. Well, I've tried them as late as November and even later than that. And if you're looking for sugar, the highbush cranberry is a poor choice, because I have never tasted a highbush cranberry that really made me want to have a second. They are bitter or sour, but never sweet. I have heard people making highbush cranberry into various jellies and jams, but it takes an inordinate amount of sugar in order to make those berries palatable. I guess I would just rather have something else. And birds aren't much different. If you watch the birds, you'll see that they'll eat a lot of other berries before they'll turn to the highbush cranberry for a meal. And that is because they aren't very tasty.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. And from UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG, our purpose is people.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadil in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Michelle Martin in New Orleans at member station WWNO.
20 years ago, Hurricane Katrina opened the door for Louisiana state officials to transform New Orleans public schools. In the years following the storm, officials replaced most of the city's traditional schools with charter schools and often closed them when test scores got too low. Aubrey Yuhas of member station WWNO joins us now to talk about the churn of New Orleans' charter system and what it's meant for families. And she's with us now. Aubrey, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So before Katrina hit, New Orleans schools were generally seen to be in rough shape. As briefly as you can you explain why and why the move to charter schools in particular?
Yeah, so the story starts, you know, like for a lot of systems, with white flight picking up in the 1970s. Schools suffered from neglect, mismanagement, and in New Orleans later, a lot of corruption. By the 90s, many buildings were falling apart, lacked basic supplies like textbooks and toilet paper, and all of that obviously impacted student achievement. Test scores in New Orleans were among the lowest in Louisiana when Katrina hit. And only about half of all students graduated from high school on time. One former teacher told me it felt like the school system had reached the end of its life. So then the storm hit and schooling in the city came to a complete stop. Buildings had been destroyed, teachers and students were displaced. And in that pause, state officials hit reset. They took over most of the city's public schools and over the next decade turned all of them into charter schools.
Aubrey, how did people in New Orleans feel about that? Because I have to say that in the times that I've been in New Orleans reporting on this, the thing that I heard over and over again is that many people felt like this was something that the state was doing to them, not with them. Did you find that in your reporting?
Yeah, I mean, I think people agreed that the system needed to change, but this takeover was a hostile one. It, like you said, it was not something that was done with community involvement. There were clear, you know, racial tensions, like this majority Black city, majority Black teachers, and white lawmakers and other charter leaders from outside of the city all of a sudden making all of the decisions and really trying to wipe the slate clean. Teachers, mostly Black teachers, lost their jobs. The names on buildings were changed. Carlos Luis Zervagon attended and taught in the city schools before Katrina. And he says a lot of people felt like they lost their homes in the storm and then their schools.
For those who were here, for those who remember, the wound will not go away. It will not, because it was trauma upon trauma.
Eventually, the state gave control over the schools back to the city. And by then, local officials were on board with this idea of an all-charter system. And that's the main reason we ended up with the public school system we have today, where the district only runs one of its more than 60 schools directly. The rest are charter schools.
Okay, so go back to charter schools. Why charter schools specifically? What made them so appealing?
Yeah, so back in the 2000s, if you can remember, charter schools were this popular bipartisan idea. And just to remind folks, like, these are free schools, they're publicly funded, and in Louisiana, they're run by nonprofit, non-elected boards, though they have to answer to local school boards. And the idea was to empower individual schools to make their own decisions and empower parents to decide where to send their kids, inserting some competition into public education. For New Orleans, you know, it meant freeing schools from a system that a lot of people felt was barely functioning at the time. And they also created a mechanism to close schools that officials thought were failing. Closures happen frequently, even, you know, today, and they can be really painful and disruptive for families. So that's definitely a huge trade-off. But the system has also scored some wins.
Okay, well, so tell us about that. What were some of the ways families benefited here?
Yeah, I mean, because this was a really novel experiment at the time, there was so much support from outside of the city coming in, people who wanted to open schools, work in them, money, other resources. And in terms of the numbers, test scores and graduation rates increased dramatically in the decade after the storm, and they still look pretty good today. Some researchers like Doug Harris of Tulane University attribute those gains to what I was talking about earlier, the district's willingness to close schools.
If you close low-performing schools, students end up in better schools, and they do better, which sounds really obvious when you put it that way, but I think is not how it typically happens in most places.
So you've been talking to families who've experienced school closures. What did they tell you?
Yeah, let me introduce you to Danielle Smith.
I'm a mother of a child that knows where we came from.
Her daughter Kyla has a learning disability, and Smith says at school she didn't always get the support she needed.
We came from an adult space.
But when she got to high school at Living School, things were different. The school's slogan was learn by doing. Students tended banana trees in biology and started their own businesses.
I felt that was interesting because learning as you go was something different.
Everyone was learning at their own pace, Smith says. And Kyla really thrived.
You know, she developed a strong sense of confidence.
Living School's charter was up for renewal Kyla's junior year. And while the school board looks at a lot of different factors, test scores carry the most weight. And Living Schools scores had recently dipped. It received a failing grade from the state, and local officials started talking about closing the school.
Good evening. I'm calling to order the Orleans Parish School Board business meeting for December 4th.
At a school board meeting, the district superintendent, Avis Williams, gave her recommendation.
Living school non-renewal and same reason, an F as
that night, more than 20 people asked the board to reconsider, including current and former students Genesis Betis Bustillo, Recal Hooker, and Rio Valdez.
Without this school and the teachers that actually care about your learning, I would fail math so fast. I promise you I would not be in college right now.
I probably would not have graduated.
In response, longtime board member Nolan Marshall acknowledged one of the biggest flaws in the city's school system. It was supposed to accommodate innovation, he said, so schools could help students. That's what Living School was doing. And yet,
you are judged by test scores more than anything else. We all know that that's unfair, but it is the system that we have.
The district now weighs student growth more heavily, but that change came too late for Living School. Ultimately, the board voted to close it in 2024. Danielle Smith says she and her daughter were devastated.
That sense of peace was gone when I know I had the school was closed, and I was like, oh my God, like, where are we going to go now?
There's definitely a limit to how far you can go with this strategy.
Tulane's Doug Harris has been studying New Orleans' charter school system for over a decade.
One way to think about it is that we went from being an F to a C, but I don't think this strategy gets you from a C to even a B.
And that means the system needs to try something different if it wants to keep getting better.
So what's next for New Orleans? Is it time for the city to transition to something else, or are charters there to stay?
Yeah, I mean, charter schools are definitely here to stay. They've brought a lot of good to the city. But an all-charter system, you know, maybe not that. Carlos Luis Zervagon, the former teacher I spoke to, is now on the school board. He points out that charter schools here are more closely regulated than they were in the beginning, and they have far fewer freedoms than charter schools elsewhere.
We do have a system, just a different system. And I'd say it is guided by the principle that we believe if it works, do it. If it don't work, stop doing it. If it needs changing, change it.
Zervagon says the next step is to be less reliant on charters to make sure the city's kids get a good education. He wants the district to consider running some schools directly when it makes sense. Last year, for the first time in a while, the school district opened a school of its own. And that's something that, you know, felt pretty impossible just 5 years ago.
Aubrey Yuhas reports on education from member station WWNO in New Orleans. Aubrey, thank you.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
It is 5:42. Thank you for listening to the Thursday morning show on KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up just after 7 o'clock, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. You can also find lots of local news stories and conversations at kaxc.org. Support comes from the Northland Foundation, working within Northeast Minnesota, offering grants, small business supports, and programs to help people and communities, working toward a future where everyone feels they belong and can thrive. More at northlandfdn.org. The Bemidji Senior Center hosts a Medicare presentation Wednesday, September 3rd at 1 p.m. Learn about the plans available before open enrollment, which begins October 15th. And Itasca Waters continues their Practical Water Wisdom webinar series Thursday, September 4th at noon. This month, learn about storm water runoff and the problems it can cause. Register at itascawaters.org. You can find a map of area public beaches at our website, kaxc.org. While you're there, you can also share your favorite beach with us if it's not on our list, and we will add it to the map. The History of Jazz airs Saturdays at noon, Sundays at 4 with host Paul Kivi, exploring the distinctly American art form. You can also hear more jazz Sundays, 6 p.m. on Jazz on America Avenue, hosted by our volunteers. There's more ahead for Morning Edition.
In the past, we knew more about our neighbors. I'm Heidi Holton, and KEXC provides that. We get to know the people that live in northern Minnesota, like Kathy Davies on What's for Breakfast.
Well, truly, every day I wake up with you guys, and so there's socialization. And I love the local news. That interview with Amy Klobuchar this morning was wonderful. I am so supportive of finding out what's going on with all the tribal stations, and I care about the Canadian wildfires. I love to hear about everything that's local. You know, I've been to Riverfest, and that was fantastic. I listen to and support KAXC because you guys are what it's all about up here.
When you donate to KEXE, you're supporting your local community. Help us out now during this crisis of the defunding of public media from the federal government. Thank you for being there for KEXE. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
NPR comes from this station. And from Betterment, an automated investing platform that strives to make it easy to be invested. Learn more at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Unhoused people across the country are feeling the impact of extreme heat from a warming climate. And as Connecticut's Public's Abigail Brown reports, leaders in various states are working to meet the need for shelter during heat emergencies.
When the weather warms up, Connecticut resident Clarence Braun and his wife Holly park their Mercury Grand Marquis in the shade, or ride around with the windows down.
Oh, my AC's broken. I just drive if I can.
Ron has lived out of the car for more than 2 years. But when it gets really hot, he seeks out some AC relief.
Got a little AC here at McDonald's. They got AC if you really need to cool down, you know. They don't much like it, but they allow it for a little bit.
On a hot summer day in July, Ron, wearing a short sleeve red polo and his hair pulled back in a ponytail, visited the Connecticut Harm Reduction Alliance in Hartford. This place serves as a cooling center on this day, and bottles of vitamin water and cold cut sandwiches were available. Mark Jenkins is the founder of the alliance.
We loaded a pallet of water in here yesterday. It's probably all but gone. 48 cases of 40 bottles inside a 12-hour period.
To stay open longer, Jenkins brings on extra staff. Connecticut, a state that sees its first frost in late September and snowfall as late as April, is seeing drier and hotter summers due to climate change. An extreme heat protocol for the state was established in 2021. It's triggered when there are three or more consecutive days of temperatures above 90 degrees. So far this year, the state's heat protocol was put in place 5 times, up from 3 last year. Donald Whitehead, executive director of the National Coalition for the Homeless, says the state's seeing a rise in heat, like Connecticut, don't always have a summer shelter system in place.
So there's always been in the Midwest and the East Coast the need to have those kinds of facilities for the cold. But now it actually is becoming almost a year-round activity.
30 years ago, Chicago experienced a record-breaking heat wave in which more than 700 people died. It led to the formation of a city office, which coordinates public universities and schools and libraries to function as cooling centers. Dr. Alexander Sloboda, with Chicago's Department of Public Health, says high temperatures are particularly dangerous in large cities.
We kind of have this urban heat island effect, and so even though kind of the environment cools down a bit, like the concrete, the buildings continue to release the heat absorbed during the day into the evenings.
Opening cooling centers during heat waves is providing relief to some, but people are continuing to die.
The city is trying to provide more either later cooling center hours or even exploring 24/7 options as well.
In parts of Arizona, the heat season typically runs from May to October. Eugene LeVar, chief heat officer for Arizona, says that since last year, the state has opened 9 around-the-clock cooling centers that operate during the heat season.
And those could include for the unhoused, those that are house burdened, or those that are just seeking, you know, some relief because they may be housed, but they could be making some really critical decisions between utilities and different, you know, needs that they have.
LeVar says these shelters are helping. For the first time in nearly a decade, Phoenix saw a small decline in the number of heat-related deaths. For NPR News, I'm Abigail Brown.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
Join us for the 5th Annual Grand Rapids River Fest, Saturday, September 6th, presented by KAXE, the City of Grand Rapids, and sponsored by Grand Rapids State Bank. The lineup features Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Come along for a day of great music along the banks of the Mississippi River. Tickets available now at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com.
What's in store for NVIDIA?
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Odoo, dedicated to providing software designed to scale with businesses. Odoo's programs for manufacturing, accounting, and more aim to provide building blocks for creating a custom software suite. Odoo, what businesses need. And by Yubico, makers of the YubiKey. YubiKey helps protect important digital applications and services. YubiKey, still undefeated, the original passkey. More at yubico.com.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishor, in for David Brancaccio. NVIDIA, maker of AI and gaming chips, is not quite meeting Wall Street's lofty expectations. The company announced second quarter results yesterday, which were pretty good, but they fell short in one key area. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that.
NVIDIA computer chips help power AI and the data centers being built by the likes of Google and Meta. Its newest chip, the Blackwell, is selling briskly, but NVIDIA's data center revenue came in below analysts' expectations, sparking fears of a slowdown in AI spending. Still, the company reported overall revenue for the second quarter of more than $46 billion, up 6% from the last quarter. It's expecting to rake in even more money this quarter. NVIDIA designed a special chip for China, but it didn't sell any of them to China in the second quarter and doesn't include any China's sales of the chip in estimates for this quarter. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
President Trump has been relentlessly trying to gain control over the Federal Reserve, attacking its independence, most recently with the ongoing attempt to fire Fed Governor Lisa Cook. But what specifically does the president want from the central bank? Well, he wants lower interest rates. The current federal funds rate, these are the short-term rates between banks that spill over into the rest of the economy, the current rate is around 4.5%. The president would like it down to 1%. So what if that happened? Marketplace's Justin Ho has that.
Let's say the Federal Reserve cuts the federal funds rate to 1% tomorrow. George Perks, macro strategist at Bespoke Investment Group, says the first place he'd see a reaction would be in government bond yields.
So interest rates would drop across the entire benchmark treasury curve.
Meaning both short-term and long-term rates. Perk says those influence all kinds of credit throughout the economy.
One example would be auto loans. So for a given dollar amount that you can spend on a car payment every month, you would be able to buy a lot more car because you have a lower interest rate that you have to pay on your borrowing.
Business loans would also get cheaper. Perk says companies would likely borrow more to expand and to hire people.
Taken together, you just see a range of factors that would point to a hotter economy, certainly, but also significantly higher inflation than the already above target inflation we have right now.
That's because more demand for workers would push up wages. More demand from consumers and businesses would push up prices. And if inflation picks up again, there would be some unintended consequences.
We would see, ironically, yields on long-term debt increase.
That's Daryl Fairweather, chief economist at Redfin. She says investors would demand higher yields on longer-term debt because inflation would otherwise eat away at their returns. And remember, yields on longer-term bonds affect the cost of mortgages.
Mortgage rates, they would go up, and it would actually make it more expensive for people getting long-term debt, and that would probably hurt the housing market.
Even though President Trump has argued that the Federal Reserve is the one hurting the housing market by keeping rates too high. So I asked Fairweather whether a lower federal funds rate would make mortgages more affordable.
No, that is not going to accomplish that goal.
One thing a drastic rate cut would do is undermine the credibility of the Federal Reserve.
Then that could lead to an exodus of capital.
Ann Villamil is an economics professor at the University of Iowa. She says that exodus could push interest rates on government bonds higher, too.
To compensate for the risk of the Fed losing its credibility. And that's what markets do. They price out risks.
That's why even if the president thinks lower rates would be good for the economy, markets would think otherwise. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
All right, let's do the numbers. The FTSE in London is down about 0.5%. Dow futures are up 0.1%. S&P futures are up less than 0.1%, pretty much flat. NASDAQ futures down less than 0.1%, also pretty much flat. The yield on the 10-year Treasury is 4.23%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering a small ship experience with a shore excursion included in every port and onboard cultural enrichment. Discover more at Viking.com. And by This Old House Radio Hour podcast, answering listeners' DIY and renovation questions and diving into home design trends, available in podcast apps.
Technology has made it so much easier to apply for a lot more jobs. Before, it was digital job boards. Now AI helps people tweak their resumes and cover letters in seconds and then blast them out, practically automating job application. But AI has also helped employers automate sorting through all those applications. Our friends over at Marketplace Tech have been reporting on the trade-offs involved when AI meets the job search. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino spoke with Oliver Golden Egan about his ongoing job search.
I have not gotten traction on any applications that I have not had some sort of personal connection to.
He graduated from Pomona College on scholarship last year. After interning at Harper's Magazine, he's been looking for full-time work in publishing. He usually tries to cold contact an employee of his target company so he can send his resume via email. He's even thought about delivering application materials on paper, in person.
I don't come from a background that's necessarily replete with those kinds of connections. My mother's a housekeeper.
AI application systems are often sold as fixes to the traditional biases in hiring. But Princeton computer science professor Arvind Narayanan says they introduce new unfairness.
The experience that we put these job seekers through, right, being interviewed by a robot essentially, I think it's kind of a violation of basic dignity.
He says there's little evidence AI can accurately predict who will excel at a job in most cases.
To hear the full report, you can head over to marketplace.org. And by the way, if you want to be clued in to the day's economic news, you can sign up for our daily newsletter. We will bring you the best of Marketplace in your inbox. Sign up at marketplace.org/subscribe. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
It's a minute before 6 o'clock. Good morning. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXC.org. You can click the donate button and become a member. We thank you so much for your support. There's also lots of local news stories and conversations. KAXC.org. Patchy fog early this morning, then becoming mostly sunny, highs 67 to 75. Our lows overnight, mid-40s to low-50s, and tomorrow mostly sunny, highs in the low to mid-70s. Looking ahead to Saturday, sunny, highs in the mid to upper 70s. Support comes from Dragonfly Coffee in